God's grace is real and free for all who seek it. Therefore, redemption is not only possible, it's natural. I am three people. I am the person I was till I was 16. And the person I was from 16 to 27. And the man I am today. My name's Carlson. I'm an alcoholic. I've been sober since January the 14th of 1985. I'm a member of the Shreveport Young People's Group, which is the best group in the known universe. I hope you feel that way about yours. If you don't, you possibly need to find another home group. Working on the fields of Mississippi, when I say working on the fields, I mean work standing on them, moving around. Working on the fields of Mississippi with my brother at the age of 9, helping him build fences on my father's farm, which I'd rather been doing anything else than working on fences in the fields when I was 9 on my father's farm. I would have rather been watching TV. I would have rather been doing just about anything else except for working in the fields with my brother at the age of 9. My mind as a young person was always somewhere else. I was always in my head. I was always in an imaginary place. I was always with imaginary friends. And I was never where I was at, concentrating on what I was supposed to be doing. My particular job was to pull barbed wire. That was my job. It was busy work. They would give the busy work to the 9-year-old. His job was to pull barbed wire, which barbed wire is on a spool, and it would drag upon the ground, and I held it with this metal-shaped U-thing. And it was the most miserable part of my day for a whole summer, was to drag this barbed wire. And in this particular year, it hadn't rained for about a month. And if you've ever been in the open field when it hasn't rained for a really long time, you know how dry it is, especially when you start to dehydrate and work and sweat. Well, over this weekend, the clouds hung low in the sky, and it looked like the rivers were just going to let loose and flood. So that meant the earth was dry, but the air was moist. And so all day I knew that at any moment it was going to rain, and I could go home, and I could do what I wanted to do. I could go to those faraway places. I could watch TV. I could do whatever I wanted to do. So I did what any respectable 9-year-old kid would do. I prayed for rain. I mean, why not? After all, I was a good Christian. I had been baptized. My grandfather was a Southern Baptist preacher. If that didn't put me in good with the Lord, what would? Well, I would like to report to you that I was a very happy 9-year-old, that I was a very outgoing 9-year-old, that I was a very industrious 9-year-old, that I enjoyed all the things that my father assigned me to do, but that's just not the case. I was a grumpy 9-year-old. I was a rebellious 9-year-old. I complained, I moaned, I whined about it the whole time. And while dragging the barbed wire, if I wasn't crying, it's because all the liquid had drained out of my body. I got hung up on a stump dragging the barbed wire. The barbed wire got hung. And rather than stopping and unhanging the barbed wire, I just stood there, grinding my heels into the dirt, complaining to myself about why it was that it wasn't raining. Because after all, I was a good Christian. My grandfather was a Southern Baptist preacher. If I wasn't in good with the Lord, who was? Well, I just had about enough. I got extremely angry, and I raised my hand to the heavens, and I let out, well, if you won't let it rain, just damn you then. And a lightning bolt struck the tree over my head. And I dropped the metal piece I had in my hand, and I ran home. That was the extent of my relationship with God for many, many years. That was the extent of my relationship and belief in a higher power. Two things had been confirmed to me. that yes, there was a divine being. No, he was not going to let it rain. The big book of Alcoholics Anonymous tells me that I have a disease. And it describes that disease in the doctor's opinion. It says that I have an obsession of the mind, and I have something called phenomena of craving, that whenever I take a drink, whenever I put a drop of alcohol in my system, I don't react like normal people. I react differently. I never meant to, you see. I mean, how many times did I go out and say to myself, okay, I'm going to have X number of beers? And how many times did X number of beers end up being a week? That's how I drank. When I read for the first time the doctor's opinion, the thing that struck me the most clear was how much like it I was. Not how different I was, how much like it I was. The differences were hard to find. Now, when you're 16 years old, learning about recovery for the first time, you know, you would think, well, it'd be real easy. All you got to do is look at the age. All you got to do is look and see how all these people were much older than you. Well, it never struck me that way. What struck me was how much like them I was. When I would talk to the members of Alcoholics Anonymous, what struck me was how much like them I was. First time I ever drank alcohol was at a Christmas party. You know, I grew up on a farm. You know, Dad made really good money in the oil fields, you know. And he was the patriarch of the family, so all the brothers, sisters, uncles, cousins, everyone descended on our home for Christmas. And when you've got that many Floyds running around, it's hard to keep track of the little ones. So my sister and one of my mother's younger uncles were mixing drinks. And in one particular drink, I think it had about this much Jack Daniels and a little bit of coloring to disguise it. And that got handed to me, and I drank it. And that's the first time I can ever remember drinking alcohol. It did not make me sick. I did not necessarily like the way it tasted, but I did like one thing. I liked the way it made me feel. You know, in the doctor's opinion, the big book talks about that. It says alcoholics drink essentially because they like the effects produced by alcohol. It creates a sense of comfort and ease. And I always had that. From the very first time I ever drank, I had a sense of comfort and ease that nothing else ever gave me. So I drank it, and I did things that night I'd never done before. I drove my motorcycle through the bonfire trying to light my bottle rocket. That was the extent of my wild evening. But I never forgot that evening. I never forgot that evening. I never forgot the way it made me feel. Years later, we moved to Shreveport. And Shreveport changed our environment a little bit. You know, when you take a country kid out of the country and you put him in Leave It to Beaver neighborhood, you know, my nearest neighbor when I was a kid was a mile and a half away, and he was my father's second cousin. So living in a place where not only did we not know the people living next door, they lived right next door. I mean, you couldn't even step out on your front porch, Howard, and take a leak, for crying out loud. I mean, what kind of place was this? I met some new friends, and they liked to do things like sneak out of the house at night. And we would sneak out of the house at night, and we would wander around the neighborhoods unsupervised. And we would take things that didn't belong to us, misappropriate things, rearrange things in the neighborhood. Now, adults would call us vandals, hoodlums, criminals, thugs. I hate to tell you things that we did because you might have been one of the people we did it to, which means I'll have to make amends to you right after this. But I'll go ahead and give you an example of some of the things we did. We used to love to unscrew the antennas off people's cars. And we would unscrew the CB antennas off cars until we got like 50 or 60 of them, and then we'd place them on a corner on the street so that they could sort them out later as they were driving to work. There was only two ways to get in and out of the neighborhood. And we would hide in the bushes and watch people come by and sort through the CB antennas trying to figure out which one was there. Innocent stuff at first, but later it turned into other things. One afternoon with this group of guys, we decided to go into one of the local businesses and misappropriate some of the alcohol. We broke into a business and we stole their liquor cabinet. And we hid it in the ditch right behind the business because we were really smart like that. I mean, that's how teenagers think, you know. No one will look right behind the ditch, right behind the business. And then the next day, in August, we went up to the local 7-Eleven and we got Big Gulp Cup. No ice, just bought the cup. No Coke, just a cup. Needed something to mix the drinks with. And we went back to this ditch. And I began mixing my first real drink all by myself. And I mixed things like Jim Beam, Jack Daniels, gin, vodka, and this Big Gulp Cup. And then I held my nose and I drank the whole thing. And I was mixing my next drink. When suddenly, as if by magic, I was in the living room of my home being slapped in the face by my father. Now, according to story and rumor, I was the life of the afternoon. I entertained everybody. I had a really good time in that ditch. I threw up on myself. I fell down a lot. I apparently tried to climb out of the ditch quite often, would roll back down. And I did that for 4 or 5 hours. So the very second time I ever drank to get drunk, I had a blackout. And another strange thing happened to me as I woke up. I felt the urge to vomit. And this would be an ongoing thing in my drinking, vomiting. So I felt the urge to vomit. And now I'm going to stop for a minute. I want to tell you a little bit about my dad. Now, my dad is a lot like John Wayne. If you've ever seen the movie where John Wayne portrays a guy by the name of Red Adair, that's my father. Big, tough, stern-looking, very smart, very intelligent, very successful. You know, he worked from nothing to where he was, and he was in his business suit trying to get me to wake up, and the first thing I did was throw up on him. And I couldn't eat or drink for about a week. I mean, you could come in the room and unscrew a cap of alcohol in the room with me, and I would get a sick feeling and vomit. Now, Dad wanted to know who I was with. And that was one of the primary concerns, because is that not always one of your parents' first reactions? If the people you hung out with were better, this wouldn't happen to you. So we want to know who you were hanging out with so that we can spread this guilt around for everybody. But, you know, I'm a tough kid. I held out 2-3 minutes before I started giving names and addresses. I mean, I was loyal. I mean, when you get consequences like, well, these are consequences without names and these are consequences with names, hey, consequences with names were working better for me. So, you know. But there's also another thing that I had to remember, and I can... It's like remembering a feeling. And the thing is that I never put together the alcohol and the consequences. Even though alcohol would make me sick, what I kept thinking to myself was that I did it wrong. Number one, you're not supposed to mix all those different kinds of alcohol, those different brand names with other brand names. Number one, that's a mistake. Number two, on a hot day like that, you should have ice. And number three, you should have the appropriate non-alcoholic beverage to go with your alcoholic beverage, such as Coke with Crown whiskey, water, orange juice with vodka. And because the next time I kept telling myself that I drink, I'm going to do it right. Never did it occur to me not to drink again. Because just for a moment there, while I was mixing that second drink, it felt really good. Just like it did the first time. And that's the way my drinking progressed. My father died a short time after that, and that left me alone with my mom. And, you know, when people are going through grief and they've never really had to raise children by themselves, you know, I got away with murder. I could do anything I wanted, whenever I wanted, how I wanted, and I did. And I drank that way from that evening when I was 11 years old in that ditch until I was 16 years old. I continued to drink and do other kinds of mood-altering chemicals. In my generation, when you're drinking and you're a teenager, if you've only drank alcohol, man, you're rare. I did other kinds of mood-altering chemicals too, but there's one true thing about that. I was always an alcoholic, and I never would have did any of those other things had I not been an alcoholic. I drank first, I drank last, and I drank in the middle. And I had a lot of good time. Dennis, I had a lot of fun drinking. There was a lot of good, fun times drinking. And if I just sit down and let the feelings and the thoughts flow, I can think about all the good times I had. And some of them are really funny stories. But I can't check some of the really bad stories. Like when I was 16 years old, towards the end of my drinking, and I turned out to be one of those kind of guys that you didn't want your daughter to be with, or your son. I turned out to be the guy you didn't want to owe money to. I turned out to be that guy. I wasn't nice. And me and a buddy of mine skipped school one day, and we had these two preppy girls with us. And I don't understand that. Now, we were two hoodlums, thieves, really bad guys, and we had these two preppy girls with us. I don't know why. And we're in my house, and we're drinking, having a good time, when one of the girls looks up into the gun cabinet and they say, "Hey, want to play Russian roulette?" And I think to myself, okay. So I get the gun out, you know, and I'm putting a bullet in it, and she's standing there, and they're kind of chatting, and I spin it, click it, put the gun to my head, and click. No big deal, because I've done this many times. I had seen that movie about the Vietnam guys, and they played the game, and they played Russian roulette. I'd been doing that for a long time. I just thought it was coincidental that she looked up into the gun cabinet and asked if you wanted to play that game. So there I stood with the gun to my head, click. And when I focused in on these people, there were these two preppy girls standing there, bows in their hair, blonde hair, you know, those little shorts with the polos on, and big white eyes with their mouths hanging open. And I was like, I looked over at my hoodlum friend, long black hair, kind of greasy with his black coat on, big white eyes with his mouth hanging open, looking at me. So I'm clicking the gun open, and this little preppy girl who had challenged me to do that, she said, "You're nuts, and you're crazy if you think I'm doing that." I never stopped. I never flinched. I never hesitated as I closed the gun, cocked it back, put it right between her eyes, and pulled the trigger. That's the kind of alcoholic I was. Those are the kind of things that I did. Is that insane? Is that insanity? That wasn't the first time I did something like that. Wasn't the last time I did something like that. I repetitively did the same things again and again and again, expecting things to be different. Expecting things to be different. I remember this one evening, coming up the stairs to my urban home, real nice, expensive place, you know, and I around the corner, and my father, who's been dead for 4 or 5 years now, and I'm at the end of my drinking, and I come around to my mother's room, and she's lying in the middle of the floor, crying, surrounded by empty coin holders, silver coin holders. She's surrounded by them. These weren't just silver dollars. They were awards that my father had won throughout his career, given as special service, hundreds of them, and he had won. And they were all gone now, except for two. Because I had stolen them, and I had pawned them. And my mother was laying in the middle of the floor, wailing and crying. And there was only one person that could have done it. And I could not ever replace them. See, I won't forget that. It hurt then. It hurt then. In the midst of my drinking and my using, it hurt then. But when you're a selfish, self-centered alcoholic, he only has one objective, yourself. Does anything else really matter except what you want at the moment? Didn't for me. Consequences didn't mean anything. I'd deal with that later, and when later came, I still didn't deal with it. I had these moments of clarity. And this moment of clarity, the first one I had, came as I was sitting with a group of friends, because we like to go ride our dirt bikes. I used to race ATVs. And you know, if you're going to race ATVs, you got to practice. You have to be good at that sort of thing. And we were sitting around drinking and doing some other stuff, about eight of us, you know, and it was time to go practice, and everyone was getting up to leave, and I said, hang on, guys, let's have one more. And one of the guys turned and looked at me and said, Carlson, man, don't you like to do anything else besides drink? And the room kind of got quiet, and then everyone laughed, and they were joking, and we had one more, but for me. See, I answered the guy in my mind. And the answer to that question was, well, no, actually, I don't like to do anything else. This is all I like to do. And it bothered me. My second moment of clarity came a couple of weeks later in the form of my older brother. I'm the runt. He's the big guy. And my older brother tried to fill my father's shoes, and he tried to put some discipline in the house when he was there. And he came across his very younger, rebellious younger brother who didn't take kindly to his discipline. So acts of discipline usually erupted into fistfights, especially towards the later years of my drinking. And I had done something to upset my mother, and she got upset and was crying and had left. And my brother came into the kitchen. I can still see him as he's circling around. And I knew what he was fixing to do. You know, he was fixing to cold cock me. And when I looked up, he's standing there, and he's looking at me, and he's got tears in his eyes. And he says, you're not worth it. Because you don't know the difference between your lies and the truth anymore. And he turned around and he left. And once again, I answered him, no, I don't. No, I did not know the difference between the true and the false anymore. I tell you, when I read the big book, when I read the doctor's opinion, when I read there is a solution, when I had other people share their experience, strength, and hope with me, it read like they were reading my soul, like they were reading my mind, like they were reading the things that had happened to me. Just playing over and over again. I ended up in treatment in a very kind of a strange way, I think. Treatment's kind of an interesting place to go if you've never been in treatment. I highly recommend it. It's very relaxing. Costs a hell of a lot, but it's very relaxing. I recommend treatment. If it hadn't been for treatment, I wouldn't be sober today. So I want to go on the record of saying that. But Jesus Christ, $42,000 for a big book. You know what I mean? My sister was a real alcoholic. She put me to shame. She and I would have drinking contests and other contests, and she always put me under the table. And I thought I drank a lot. I could drink my older brother under the table, the once or twice he actually drank with me. But my sister could drink fifth and drive home. She was in treatment, and one morning we were scheduled to go to Jackson, Mississippi, and do a family session with the counselors to explain to them why my older sister was an alcoholic and needed to be in treatment. There's some comedy in that for me. Because the funny thing was, I was looking forward to going and narking on her. I mean, my sister's the kind of person who would catch me in the middle of the floor passed out, not wake me up, but go wake up my mother and say, I think I heard something downstairs. So I was looking forward to this trip. But alcohol had caught up with me. You know, I had once again registered no grade point average at high school. All I ever really did at high school was go and hang out with people I drank with. I mean, I failed the 3 years I was in high school. I don't think I ever got out of the ninth grade. So at the end of one semester, my mother worked at a bank, and she didn't get home till like 6:30. It was 2:15, so I did what any respectable drunk would do in his mother's absence. I threw a party with all my friends, everybody in high school. And a couple hundred people showed up at the house, and we tore the place up for 3 hours, and then I threw everybody out because I realized all they were doing was drinking my stuff. And then I left before Mom got home. And then when I walked back through the door, she met me at the door doing that mother thing with that high-pitched voice that they do wearing a nightgown. shaking her hands back and forth, and I had no idea what was wrong with her because I had forgotten about the party that I had thrown that afternoon because I'm an alcoholic, and we forget about shit we're not supposed to have done. You know, that convenient denial system that we put in place. So as I rounded the corner, I looked at the bar, and she had categorized and alphabetized all of the paraphernalia because Carlson had left all of the cleanup in the house in clear trash bags. So when she got home that day, the first thing she saw were 3-4 huge trash bags full of alcohol, you know, bottles, cans. And she sat there raving at me, but, you know, I didn't care anymore. I could have cared less. And she and I had been playing that game for a long time, you know, where she pretended like I wasn't and I pretended like she didn't know. So I reached in my pocket, pulled out some funny blue pills, reached down and pulled out my aunt's vodka bottle, and every time my mother opened her mouth, I put a pill in my mouth and I took a shot of vodka until magically she disappeared. The next morning, I got up, took a shower, got in the back seat of my mom's car, woke up in Jackson. Went into the doctor's office with my recovering sister. I mean, after 10 days, Jesus had spoke to her. She was a new person. And you know how new drunks are. I, you know, just full of energy and wants to save the world. And then I suddenly realized that I possibly wasn't going to be doing any confronting. Sister didn't say anything. I didn't say anything. And at the end of the session, the counselor looked at me and she asked me if I had anything to say. And I said that I thought I was a chemically dependent person. Those were the words I used, and I could really use some help through sobbing tears. Now, about 5 or 10 minutes later, I was really wondering what it was I had just done to myself. So let me give you a word of advice, all of you people. If you are sitting in a 4-story building on the second floor, deep in the bowels of a chemical dependency center, you have insurance, you tell them you have a drinking problem, you're not going anywhere. You are there until they let you go. Great movie. The stay at the Mississippi Baptist Chemical Dependency Center at the Village for Adolescents was a nice stay. I was there for 11 months. I remember the guy who was signing me in, and he said, you know, that they had an adolescent program. No, first he said, we have a program for 30 days for adults. And I thought, 30 days, I can clean up, you know, hide out here for a while, then I can go back and everything will be cool. He said, but you're not an adult. And as soon as he said that, I knew I was screwed. He said, we have an adolescent program for 4 to 6 months. Now, they kept me for 11, which means he lied. I'm just saying. After working in the treatment field for a while, what I realized is that my insurance was probably really good, so they squeezed out a few more months. This is what I learned in treatment. What I learned in treatment was a word called feelings, which I'd never knew anything about before. I never knew anything about feelings. I had things that went on the inside of me that I couldn't put names to, and I want to give you a good description of me. I had 3 words that were not cuss words when I got sober. Dude, man, and righteous. You throw in some explicitness, and it works out really good. You can express almost anything, but in treatment, they wouldn't let you use those kind of things. You know, if you'd have asked me how I felt, I would have said, well, man, I'm really pissed off. And they had to teach me a new word, anger. They had to teach me the word pain. They had to teach me the word joy. They had to teach me the word love. They had to teach me what feelings were because I had no idea. I had no idea. They cleaned me up. They taught me a little bit about steps. They taught me discipline. They taught me how to make up my bed and how to wash my clothes because I didn't know how to do that either. And then I left treatment and I went home. And they gave me a set of instructions. They gave me a contact name. They said, call this person, go to a meeting, go 30 minutes before, stay 30 minutes afterwards. And I said, yes, sir. Went home. Got home, picked up the phone, called my contact. He was drunk. Contact was drunk. I asked him if he wanted to take me to a meeting anyway. He said no. So I looked in the phone book and I looked up Alcoholics Anonymous. I called Alcoholics Anonymous. Old voice answered. You could barely distinguish the word, hello! Is this Alcoholics Anonymous? Yes! These people were completely horrified, mortified, beside myself with fear. Because through all of that, you see, there was one thing I really wanted. I really wanted to be sober. And at that moment, I knew I was going to die. Because there was no way these old people were going to do anything for me. And before I could move, before I could escape, before I could run, this big redneck had transported himself from across the room right directly in front of me. And he stuck his hand out and he said, hey, my name's Jim, and you look like you're in the right place. Boy, come over here, let me show you what a coffee is. And these two men and these two ladies sat with me and they talked with me and then they made me feel at home. No one ever said anything about the way I looked. No one ever said anything about the way I talked. And I went down to the Haven Club every night for 6 months. And they saved my life. Because if I had left there, I wouldn't have stayed sober and I would have died. I got really involved in the Shreveport Young People's Group. And the Shreveport Young People's Group did young people's conferences. Thank you. We did the Louisiana State Conference of Young People in AA. We did the second one. We created it, and then we did the second one. And I got real involved with people, young in sobriety. Now, I was the youngest by far. I was 17, and everyone else was like, 27, 28, 29, 30 years old. That was okay. That changed over the next 2 years. A lot more people, a lot younger, started coming in. But it didn't matter to me because there was one thing I wanted to be. I wanted to be sober, and I was willing to do whatever anyone told me to do. And I met the people in those first years of my sobriety who changed my life, who introduced me to this book, who taught me how to read this book. And I want to say something about that, too. There's another aspect when I got sober. I couldn't read when I got sober. They kept handing me this book, and they would tell me to read it, and they'd tell me my life depended on it, and I couldn't read it. And I was too ashamed to tell anybody I couldn't read it. And some people taught me how to read. And I learned how to read so that I could save my own life. That was my motivation. The reason I couldn't read is I'm dyslexic and I learned how to read by memorization. And apparently with all the things that I did while using when I got sober, I couldn't remember how to read. So I had to learn how again. And people in AA did that for me. I met a guy who taught me about the big book. I remember the first time I ever sat with him. He said, I've been sober for about 3 or 4 years, and I've never actually gotten into the big book. I've never actually gotten into what it says. And I remember the first time he said, okay. Actually, his name for me was funny-looking blonde-haired kid. I don't think he said my name for like 2 years. He said, what's the first step? And I muttered something, and then he hit me with his cane right across the top of my leg. Just painful. He said, nope, that's not it. Try again. So I muttered something else, and I heard it coming. Even more painful. He said, nope, that's not it. Want to try again? I went, no, sir. And so we started reading the big book, and he started teaching me. He's the guy that taught me about the first step. He's the guy that taught me about honesty. He's the guy that taught me about powerlessness. He's the guy that told me that in AA, it's not about being powerless, it's about finding a power greater than yourself. And that's what I did. The 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous introduced me to a power greater than myself. And that is the single most important thing in my sobriety. That is the object of this book. That is the object of our fellowship. You know, our war stories are war stories. Why we drank and how we drank is a common element, but that is not why we're here today. The reason why we're here today is because each and every one of us has the opportunity to have a solution to their problem. And that solution is a power greater than themselves. And if they take the 12 steps, the 12 principles, and they reach out to find their higher power, their God, then they can have God's grace. And if they have God's grace, then they have redemption. And redemption means to be something else, something more, something better, something good. Because I always thought I was worthless. I thought that everything that I had done made it impossible for me to live a normal life. I couldn't shake the images of the little blonde-haired girl who I almost killed. I couldn't shake the image of my mother lying in the middle of the floor, wailing in sorrow and tears, and I could not imagine how that one day that would all be right. You know, relationships in recovery have not been easy for me. Speaking of being about how I felt and who I was. Never easy. Always difficult. But Alcoholics Anonymous made it possible for me to develop friendship. Real friendship. Real friendship. Friendship based on trust. You know, how do you get trust? Well, you got to start with honesty. And because I was trying to live by a principle of honesty, because I knew what I had control over and what I didn't have control over, then I was able to start developing relationships. Because I had sat with another human being and did a fifth step and told them who I was and what I was able to have relationships with other people. Because I was trying to have a relationship with my higher power, I started being able to develop relationships with other people. I am responsible for the people who come in behind me in Alcoholics Anonymous. Some of the best friends I have today are those people who I've tried to help in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, my sponsor helped me, and I in turn try to help other people. And I spend most of my time trying to help young people in Alcoholics Anonymous because I know what it is to walk through the doors and be afraid. I understand that fear from that perspective. I know what it is to be so afraid that I'm angry. So afraid that I'm rageful. You know, so at first I try to be tolerant. I try to show acceptance. Being able to sponsor someone in Alcoholics Anonymous is a privilege. And, you know, I can never figure out why anyone would want me to sponsor them in the first place, because I'm not nice. I'm not a nice guy about it. But it's helped me develop relationships with people I truly care about. You know, my mother and I, when I was 27 years old, we got sick. I lived with Mom, this woman who I hurt so badly. One night, when I was 27 years old, I woke up with chest pain. And I ended up going to the doctor, and I had a heart attack, and I died. If I hadn't been in an emergency room, I'd still be dead. But they brought me back to life, literally. And I will never forget from the moment that I woke up, knowing that it was all different now. And from that, I lost everything in my life at 10 years of sobriety that I had any value on. I lost it. I lost the girl that I loved. I lost the job that I liked. And I lost myself. Because, see, I had this weird idea. You see, I thought that if I did these certain things, that I would get certain things. That if I stayed sober and did the sober thing, then I would get the house, and I would get the car, and I would get the wife, and I would get the babies, and all these nice, pretty, planned-out things would happen. Well, it doesn't work that way. There are no bargains. Doing the right thing is the right thing. Doing the right thing is its own reward. You know, when I practice the principle, I get to experience my higher power in my life. and that is its own reward. Working with a young man, trying to help him find himself, find life, that is its own reward. That's the reward. You don't get cash. You're not going to get a car later. You're not going to get a girlfriend later. That's not going to happen. If that happens, it's because you worked for that, and that's what you wanted. But it's not a reward. My mother, when I came to a few months later, told me that she had cancer. And that she had had cancer that she didn't want to tell me because I, you know, was just recovering from my own life-threatening situation. So over the next 3 years, Mom and I fought heart disease and cancer together. I got better, and she didn't. Mom got real sick. Real sick. And we fought it really, really hard. And she was a young lady. She was only 51. And I sat in a hospital room with my mother, and I held her hand as she died. I was the one who took care of the bills. I was the one who took care of the doctors. I was the one who took care of all of her personal things. The same guy who stole her precious memories, who was worthless. Alcoholics Anonymous redeemed me. And that broke my heart to have to do that. Later, it became a gift, and I thought for what it was. It was a gift to be able to be there with my mother, to stand there with my mother as she passed from this life. What a true gift that was in sobriety. Now that was a reward for right living. A direct reward from my relationship with her. Sobriety has been very good to me. Very good to me. The rewards come from inside out. And I have no idea where I'm going. I have no idea what the future holds. But there is one thing that is true today that was true when I was 16 years old. I want to be sober, and I do not wish to be the young man I was then ever again. Always a pleasure to do something for Alcoholics Anonymous. It's an even bigger pleasure to do something for your home group. And it's an even bigger pleasure to do that for your friends. And it's a true honor to be able to stand up here at this podium at Tri-State and share my experience, strength, and hope with friends. This is a grand old convention that belongs to our city, and it's a real pleasure to have had the opportunity to stand up here and do this. If you don't think the 12 steps will help you, just try them. You have nothing to lose. You have absolutely nothing to lose. If you're an alcoholic and you're a young person and you've got problems now and you continue to drink, I promise you, it will just get worse. It's not going to get better. If you want to continue drinking, that's your business. If you want to change your life, that's our business, and we will help you. Bill, thank you.